Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and my mission each week is to bring you the most interesting entrepreneurs, business people, authors, speakers, virtual assistants, web developers, anybody that I can find who are freely willing to share their business wisdom, their tips, their actionable advice, and honestly, their stories with us each week. The stories, I think, are what make these people, these interviews, so important because we get an insight as to who they are and why they're where they are right now. It's very important, I think. So anyway, today we're going to be talking about a lot of different things. There's a lot to get in this hour. A rapidly shifting and complex economy is ushering in a global restructuring of the business world. This is no surprise to anybody who's paying attention. In order to keep the organizations vital for the future, executives must respond to this new commercial age by reimagining their organization's structures, enhancing product and service offerings and leveraging emerging technical capabilities. So today I'm speaking with James Kerr, James M. Kerr. He's a management consultant, organizational behaviorist, and partner at Bloom Shapiro. He specializes in strategic planning, corporate transformation, and project and program development. He consults with many Fortune 100 firms, has worked with diverse organizations such as the Home Depot, J.P. Morgan Chase, IBM, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I don't think they're a corporation, but goodness knows these days. James is also the author of a book that I've got in my hand right now. It's called The Executive Checklist, as well as three other business texts. And we're going to be talking about the Executive Checklist a bit today. The complete title of this book is The Executive Checklist, A Guide for Setting Direction and Managing Change. And basically, it's a primer for how to set direction and manage change within the 21st century enterprise. And he's going to share some great examples today of new organizational concepts being implemented in businesses today. We had a chat a couple of weeks ago, and honestly, I wish we had recorded that. It was so fascinating. James, welcome to your Partner in Success. I'm so glad to have you here.
Well, Denise, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, we had this great kind of pre-interview a week or so ago, and we hung up. I went, oh, I should have recorded that. It was so fun. It really was.
Well, but let's anyway, do it again.
We'll do it right now. So,
okay.
Anyway, before I get too deep into asking you questions, because I have a ton, I've been reading your book. Look, I am an inveterate chess checklist person. I can't even talk today. I'm sorry. I have been making checklists and notes and Christmas card lists since I was old enough to write at about 3 or 4. I love to make checklists, but I find that if I don't have one, my day just goes straight out the window. So we're going to talk about that too. But anyway, tell people a bit about yourself.
Well, sure. Yeah. I'm a management consultant. I've been in practice nearly 25 years. I've had the opportunity to work with a whole variety of organizations, big and small, and I am now a partner at Bloom Shapiro Consulting in West Hartford, Connecticut, and we're continuing kind of on the march. We're about helping companies reimagine where they'll be in the future, helping them with strategic planning and visioning, as well as business transformation and even technology implementation.
Well, that makes sense because technology, of course, is changing at the speed of sound practically. And it just,
right.
It does make sense to kind of reimage things. We can't do business the way we used to, can we? I mean, we just can't. Things have changed too much. People now want to know you, like, and trust you. It's not enough to have these big snazzy commercials out there. You've got to actually connect with your consumer.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we kind of help companies with is that whole you know, customer experience and figuring out what are the best strategies to put into place to improve the way businesses interact with their clientele.
Mm-hmm. And before we go on, there's a big difference between customer service and customer experience. Can you expand on that a bit?
Sure. And I agree with you, Denise. There is a definite difference. You know, if you were really just focused on delivering service, then it's trying to meet the needs of the, you know, customer. If it's about providing a customer experience, it's about being able to anticipate what their needs are and have those sort of solutions already in your hip pocket so that when they're needed, you can deliver this great experience to the customer. And one of the things that we're trying to do with Bloom Shapiro Consulting is to help, you know, businesses anticipate what the needs of their customers really are. And that's a big part of what we do when we work with them on vision work and strategic planning.
I have to ask, do they kind of go, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't want to do that? Do you meet any real resistance with it? Because it sounds... You know, when you're talking with older companies that have been around for a while, I would imagine that you do meet a certain level of what? What are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some of that out there. However, I would say that many of our clients are recognizing, like, gee, I'm going to have to compete on service, and the way to do that is to really think about how am I delivering service and how can I, you know, again, anticipate my customers' needs and wants and desires and all of that. And what can I do to make, you know, this a terrific experience to do business with me? You know, how can I become easy to do business with? And there's quite a few companies right now working on ease of doing business. You know, that's a key strategy. And one of the reasons, I think, and you kind of touched on it in the intro, the game has changed. You know, you can do business really with any business organization anywhere on the planet. And, you know, gone are the days that, you know, you can have any kind of car you want as long as it's black. into real customized offerings. You know, I want it exactly the way I want it, you know, the way I want it on the timeline that I want it and so on. I mean, shoot, I don't even go to the same gas station if I find that, you know, one of their gas pumps is slow. You know, so I think that's kind of where the typical consumer is at these days. They want it their way.
Well, and I think that's absolutely correct. And customer service is important. I'm not saying that it's not. But I think the experience is what people want these days. They want to know that they're valued, that, you know, somebody, whether you're meeting that person, in, you know, person when you walk into a store, that somebody actually cares about what their wants are, what their needs are, and what their experience is going to be. Do you have any examples that you can share with us?
Oh, sure. You know, there's a whole host of different things that I bring out in my book, The Executive Checklist, that get at that. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the concept of flipping the pyramid. It kind of comes later in the book, but it's about really changing the way businesses think about how they're organized and where they place importance. There once was a time when you had kind of that pyramid structure built within an organization, and the strategic leadership senior folks are at the top of that pyramid, and the people that are really doing the work, the troops in the trenches, if you will, were kind of at the bottom of the pyramid, and consequently the importance was placed top to bottom. And what I'm suggesting in the book is that you've got to flip that. The people that are actually customer-facing are the most important assets. It's there that you want to make the investment. It's there that you want to enable, you know, great performance and great service delivery. So we've got to make investments in the front lines and maybe not so much in the corner office. So that's one of the basic themes in the book. And I talk about, you know, companies that are doing it right and why they're doing it right and companies that aren't doing it so well, you know, throughout the book, really. So anyway, to get kind of to an example, I think one of the ones that is one that's sort of in a period of transition is the Home Depot. And what's going on there is they're recognizing that women are making the bulk of the decisions regarding home improvement. And being a home improvement business, they need to be sure that they're appealing to women consumers. And what was going on when we worked with them was that, you know, they were competing pretty heavily with Lowe's, and Lowe's seemed to be gaining market share. So we started to look at that a little bit and ask, you know, why is that so? And the first thing we noticed was the customer experience is much different in both of those stores. When you walk into a Lowe's, there's a greeter, it's a linoleum floor, it's brightly lit. There's someone that's there to guide you to the right aisle to find whatever it is you're in the store shopping for. And then when you went into the Home Depot, it was a little bit darker. There were guys walking around with tool belts on. There were these scary, you know, forklift things flying around the aisles. And, you know, it was intimidating, particularly for women who aren't used to, you know, a construction site type of experience. So we started to look at that and say, hey, you know what, if you want to improve your customer experience, and two-thirds of all the choices made on home improvement are coming from the woman consumer, then you probably want to appeal to them a little bit better. And now what you're seeing is they're kind of converting the stores over to be better lit and having greeters greet, you know, customers as they walk in and guide their, you know, experience that way. So just an example of, I think, a company that's trying to do it right.
Well, I have to ask, why did it take them so long to figure out that women make most of the decisions? I mean, I've always known that.
Well,
no,
you know,
I'm serious.
What I think, yeah, no, I know. I think what they, when they first started out, I think they felt that they were able to deliver a great experience because they had actual craftsmen in the stores,
oh,
working in the aisles. You know, their model was to hire ex-military who had, you know, that were plumbers, electricians, builders, and so on. And
like
if
that.
You had a question, you had expert advice. And they were kind of appealing to the weekend, you know, tool belt crowd, right, which were the guys that like playing in the garages and building things and so on. But, you know, they quickly, as they started to see Lowe's sort of infringe on their market share, they started to say, well, what are they doing that we're not? And one of the things they were doing was they were much better at appealing to the, you know, sort of the female sensibilities.
Right. The first place I go to in both stores is straight to the ceiling fan section. I mean, I want to see all the lights, and, you know, I want to, that's always where I go. It doesn't matter which store. I want to see what's new in lighting and ceiling fans. It's very important to me. Well, that makes sense. So, because we have, where I live, we have a brand new Home Depot, and you're right, it's very, very different from other ones that I've been in.
Mm-hmm.
Very different.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even really recognized that.
Mm.
I just thought,
I mean,
even
if
it's new, you know.
Sure. But even if you watch their ads, you know, they're changing that. And this is part of the overall strategy that we helped them develop. We said, you know, you've got to make your advertisements work with women as well. And what they're running these days is you're seeing, you know, a couple holding hands with sort of Junior in tow, and he's got a little, he or she has a little red wagon that they're toting into the Home Depot. And, of course, the subliminal message is, hey, look, this is a family experience. It's safe to bring the kids. It's, you know, we're going to all go shopping today.
Right, right. Okay, so I have to ask you, Domino's, Microsoft, Nike, they're using gamification, and I have to be honest, I have no clue what that means.
Okay. Well, yeah, well, let's start with sort of a basic definition. So gamification is a way of using technology and presenting a game as a means of getting your message out there, or as a means of providing a certain capability that you didn't have before. So rather than thinking of it as simply like a system that you would log into or whatever, it's a game you can play. And while you're playing the game, you're gaining additional insight. And, of course, the company is gaining information about you as you're playing the game. So it's kind of an interesting way to engage with the companies are using to engage with their customers, kind of providing a computer-based game as a way to interface. And yeah, the ones that you're talking about are in the book as examples, and they're all doing it in sort of a slightly different way. With dominoes, you can play a game, but you can also place an order for a pizza to be delivered to your home. And with Microsoft, there's a game that you can play to kind of show what your computer skills are, and it's a way for them to potentially attract talent into the company. And then with Nike, they've got this whole line of products where they've put, you know, in essence, computer chips into their clothing, into their sneakers, and you can play the game to kind of get points for the amount of exercise you're doing. So it provides the consumer with an ability to track their exercise, but it also creates an opportunity for Nike to sell additional products to those customers. So you got a pair of sneakers, and then they can put an advertisement in there for, you know, sweatpants or what have you. So again, they're little games. You gain points. You can get, you know, little computer trophies and that kind of stuff. But it's a way for interaction to occur between the consumer and the company.
How in the world did they come up with this idea? Is this part of the just really looking forward and trying to figure out how you can keep? In my industry, we talk about sales funnels. And I don't think that what you're describing is too far different from a sales funnel.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, probably, so I guess back to my question is, so this is some very, very forward thinking. They want to get the client, the customer in, and then keep that customer forever and ever, amen. Okay.
Yeah, no, and what they did, when you think about it, it is pretty clever, right? There, that the whole gamification movement, saying, hey, look, we've got the capability to build games, but let's not just make them flat games where you've got, you know, a goal and you try to achieve the goal and you win. Why not use it as a way to actually interface with our clients? So then they end up liking playing the game, and there's some sort of incentive perhaps tied to the game, and, you know, you get points, and maybe if you buy 10 pizzas from Domino's, you get the 11th one free or what have you. But it's a way to kind of engage and keep them there, like you said. So, yeah.
That makes sense. And I guess that goes back to what you're saying about looking long-term, re-imaging, and just really engaging with your customers, which is very, very smart.
Mm. Indeed,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about Walmart. I like Walmart.
Okay.
I really do.
Okay.
Every time I mention Walmart, people go, ooh, you go to Walmart? Yes, I do. So let's talk about how Costco and Trader Joe's are taking business away from my favorite Walmart. What's going on with that? How are they doing it?
Well, the big thing that's going on there is they're really not treating their personnel so well. So consequently, the customer experience is suffering because you've got less staff in the stores to help customers find the things they're looking for or to provide service. And, you know, the salary scales and things are such that you're not attracting people and retaining them as readily as you might in some of the competitors that you mentioned. So consequently, people aren't shopping there as much because they're finding that they can get to the same price point and have a better experience, better service elsewhere. So that's kind of, you know, in a nutshell what I wrote about in the book, you know, and I did kind of compare them to Trader Joe's and others because I'm saying those companies double down on their staff. They're the ones that are saying, yes, I'm going to make an investment there because the customer experience is defined by that frontline personnel.
It really is, and I wish more companies could understand that. Like when you walk into a store, like you're talking about your slow gas, your gas pump. When I walk into a store, and I'm not a shopper, I hate shopping. Honestly, Amazon.com and you know, the brown trucks, UPS, my favorite brands.
Right.
I just don't like to shop. But when I walk into a store and I'm, you know, greeted by nothing or somebody sullen who won't get off their phone or raise their head, I whip around and leave. I don't even bother to stick around. There's just too much other competition. And I
Absolutely.
Wish people would understand that, you know, they have to... They can't just hire people and then cut them loose and hope to God that people are going to still keep coming in.
Right.
I don't understand that kind of attitude, and it seems to be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere. And it's very distressing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain complacency, I think, that's out there, but you're seeing other, you know, companies coming along and saying, hey, we're not going to be complacent. We're going to change the experience, and we're going to invest. Costco's a good example. We're going to invest in our people and make sure that it's the greatest experience possible for our shoppers, and that's how we'll lock them in, and that's how we'll compete against, you know, the Walmarts of the world, where maybe you're going to save a few dollars or something, but you're not going to get the service. So now you have a choice. You can kind of, you know, frequent the stores that treat you better or not. You know, that's up to you as a consumer. But we're going to give you that option because our focus is to give you a great experience.
All right. Well, we don't have any other option pretty much. Walmart's it, but so far I'm liking them. But that brings me to my next question in the book because, you know, I've been reading these chapters and that what we're talking about just now leads me to Whole Foods because they are kind of inverting that pyramid, aren't they? I mean, they're capping their executive pay. And what's a holacracy? Can you explain that to our audience?
Sure. A holacracy, and really Zappos is a great example of what's going
Love
on
Zappos.
There. Yeah. Holacracy is really about empowering that frontline staff again. It's creating a flatter organization and kind of creating one business, if you will, without much bureaucracy. So if a frontline staff is servicing a customer and they need to do something to satisfy this customer, they don't need to go back to a manager and ask permission. They can just do it. They have the authority and they're enabled to do what's needed to get the job done. And again, Zappos is a great example from the book. That's a company that's made a commitment to establishing holacracy. In fact, Tony Hsieh, their CEO, in their last all-hands meeting, which was the end of last year, declared that he was going to create a holacracy out of Zappos by the end of this year. And he's well on his way to doing that. So when you can call them up, if you have a pair of shoes that you just ordered and you need them changed or whatever, the person on the phone is going to be able to do that for you right away without having to bump you around to the next level of management.
So that does a couple of things. It makes the consumer very, very happy, but it also makes the employee happy too because they don't feel like they're just kind of sitting in a box looking at the employee manual waiting to be stacked or say, oh, okay, it's all right what you did.
Right.
It's
you can think
smart,
of,
but he started that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, by comparison, if you think about maybe some of your recent experiences with computer manufacturers, and then you make a phone call, you've got to say you ordered a laptop and it's not working right, and you call the number, and you know it's almost impossible for the first person you talk with to issue a new computer. Then you got to go through three layers of management before somebody might take that stance, or at least say, okay, we'll send somebody to your house to fix it. You know, so much different experience, right? You know, certainly not flat organization, because you've got to go through three layers of management to get an answer that you need, you know, as a customer.
Right. It's one of the reasons I quit doing business with Dell. I mean, seriously. Between them and not being able to understand the person on the other end of the phone because they're not in America, I finally just said, you know, you have competition. I'm going there. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad because I like Dell products, but I hated the customer experience.
Well, let's hope they're getting better at it.
We'll see. I don't know that I'll go back, to be honest with you. Like, one of your checklist items, and this is a big one for me, and I think it's important no matter if you're a solopreneur or you're a business owner or you're on the front line, bad leaders. I would love for you to expand on bad leaders because they can take down an entire organization, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm writing about in that part of the book is it's really a chapter on leadership, and I'm suggesting that if you're a leader and you're seeing that your colleagues aren't doing a good job in motivating their staff and getting the job done, it's really your responsibility to call people on it and to not tolerate it. In essence, you know, help the person develop the skills, enable that, you know, inspiration or awareness so that the person can work on becoming a better leader. And, you know, let's face it, some folks shouldn't really be leaders anyway, and be willing to take that next step if they aren't able to come around and kind of remove them from a leadership role. You know, and there's a bunch of different bad leader types that I talk about in the book. You know, there's the egotist that really feels that anything that ever happens is because it was their idea and it was, you know, they drove it and so on. And, you know, consequently they burn out their people because no one gets any credit for anything. And, you know, they've got a leader that's stealing all the credit, and, you know, you've got a staff that isn't motivated, and, you know, the customer experience suffers, and so on and so on. So there's that type of leader out there that you got to work on. You got to help them recognize that there's an impact in the way they're working that could really hurt the business. There's other bad styles, you know, the bully who's constantly bullying people, or the slave driver who's constantly pushing people past, you know, what should be reasonably expected in regard, you know, to effort and so on. So those are all kind of just examples that I try to draw out in the book and suggest what the impact of that is, and also suggest some ideas about what you can do to maybe help people either work on their leadership styles or, again, take the next step and remove them from the leadership role.
And that leads me to my next question, because it seems to me like we are in an increasingly litigious society. Mm. So do some of, and this is just an oddball question, and you may not have any data on it, but is it your sense that some people stay in leadership roles because the company just doesn't want to be sued or have a union come in and get that? It just seems to me that there's an awful lot of ickiness going on out there.
Yeah.
I know that's not a technical term, but I watch some of this stuff and go, really? Where is your pride?
Mm. Well, I don't have any hard data, but I think in working with our clients over the years, you certainly see aspects of what you're talking about. What we try to do is to help the clients, you know, work through these issues. And sometimes it's something as simple as put the person in a role that they're really good at. You know, maybe leadership role isn't something that they're necessarily good at. They don't have the skills, and you haven't made the investment necessarily to help them develop those skills. And they may be over their head a bit in that role, but they could be, say, technically excellent, and you don't want to lose their technical capability. Then maybe put them in a technical role where they don't have people reporting to them, but rather, you know, they're in a place where they can excel at being technical and coming up with technical solutions. So some of what it is isn't always fire the person or whatever. It's just find the role that they're better suited for and help them, you know, get into that role.
Right. I was looking at some of the bad leaders. You have a list of, I think, of about six. And the one that just kind of jumped out at me was the mad scientist. I love that. Can you chat a bit about it? I just went, I've got to read this. Can you chat a bit about that?
Right. Well, yeah. This is one where the leader kind of views the business that they're responsible for leading as sort of a laboratory where they can experiment on new ideas. And if they work, great. And if they don't work, then they'll leave, you know, if it's really something bad. And I've got an example from a client where they had, you know, the senior person decided that it would be a really good idea to take the marketing person and put him in charge of operations, and take the operations person and put him in charge of marketing, because these two people are constantly bickering. Well, the thing is, there's a natural sort of challenge between an operations person who's got to deliver the product and the salesperson who's trying to sell the product. Sometimes the sales guy overpromises, and now that puts, you know, pressure on the operations guy to figure out how to produce it fast enough to meet the demand that the sales guy's established. So there's a natural kind of thing going on there. And what this CEO decided to do is, well, because you both are constantly complaining about one another, I'm going to switch your responsibilities so you can sort of live a year in the other guy's shoes.
Ouch. Now, that couldn't have ended well.
No, and it didn't. And consequently, you know, the sales guy left because the operations fell apart very quickly, and the CEO got sort of removed by the board because, you know, sales and the business was way off. So that's an example of someone who's kind of the mad scientist, you know, there and you know, was perfectly willing to take the risks of making those kinds of organizational changes because the person had the confidence that, okay, if it doesn't work, I'll just find another job. I'll go to another place and be a CEO at another place. And that's basically what he did. But, you know, you look at that as an outsider, as a trusted advisor. You're advising against it, you know, for the obvious reasons of the chaos that it would create. And sure enough, it created a lot of chaos, and people lost jobs, and the business suffered. And we spent the next 18 months with a new management team trying to help them put together the strategies to resurrect the business.
It sounds like he took a kindergartner, first grade teacher's approach to separating unruly children, doesn't
right.
it? It's
yeah,
like, okay,
absolutely.
Billy, you in this
yeah.
corner, you know, Josie, you in this
right.
corner, don't talk to each other. Wow.
Right.
Seems a
I
little
mean,
bit
you could,
juvenile.
Right. I mean, you could. The only way you could have really pulled that off is if both of them had experience in the other area.
Right.
But frankly, if they did, they probably would have given each other a break. You know, the fact was they didn't. You had a real operations expert on one side, and you had a real sales expert on the other. And you put the sales expert in charge of operations, and that person doesn't know what to do. And you put the operations guy in charge of sales, and he doesn't know what to do. So it really was, you know, compromised the business, really, by playing games like that.
Sounds like a horrible lapse in common sense.
Well,
okay.
I think it is.
Well,
it was.
Yeah, I think so, too. Okay, JCPenney, they took a big hit, what, a year or two ago?
Mm.
I mean, they just kind of, you know, JCPenney's has been around for a long, long time. And then all of a sudden, they changed their business model. I mean, they almost lost me as a customer, I'll be honest with you. They came
sure.
very, very close. What happened with that, and how are they fixing it, or are they fixing it?
Sure. I mean, the story that I bring out in the book is Penny, you know, hires Johnson away from Apple. Johnson was the guy that kind of came up with the whole Apple Store experience. So he was, at least in retail circles, was considered, you know, a genius. Like, look at this great thing that, you know, how they designed their store and this great experience and so on. And Penny's felt like, okay, our CEO is of retirement age and wants to retire, so let's find a replacement. They were able to hire, Ron Johnson in from Apple. And great, everybody, you know, on the Penny board felt like this is a terrific, you know, way to go. But what happened is the guy didn't last 18 months, and they had to bring the old CEO out of retirement to run the business.
I know.
And
I was watching,
you know,
that.
He's still in place today. But why it didn't work was Johnson kind of followed in the footsteps of his mentor, Steve Jobs. And Steve had like an inner circle, and that was how they kind of built Apple over the course of time. It was a very tight circle, and it was really difficult to penetrate. And information only came out of that circle when they wanted it to. And Penny's had been in one where there was more open and transparent communications. So this new CEO comes into place, and, of course, the scuttlebutt on the store floor from all the people that are working in there are saying, oh, you know, what are they going to do? What's this guy, is he going to create another, you know, Apple store out of us, you know, and what's going to happen to our jobs, and, you know, what changes are going to happen that are going to affect my life, and so on. And because there was so little information coming down, trickling down to the people, you know, on the floors, they started making up their own, you know, ideas of what must be going on. Oh, there's going to be layoffs coming, or, you know, I'm going to not be able to do this job that I really love to do. So the customer experience suffered, frankly. You know, you'd walk into the store as a customer and you wouldn't be able to find anyone to help you, or the person you found was so disgruntled it was just a bad experience. And over time, and it was a short time, less than 18 months, they really suffered. So they brought the former CEO back, and, you know, he's in the process of putting the business back on track.
Wasn't there some talk, too, or some very short-lived idea of kind of doing the, you know, the checkout in the grocery store that never works, the electronic checkout, the unmanned thing? It seems to me like there was some talk about doing away with salespeople and just having self-checkout.
Right.
That seems
that was,
and I read that and went, that's got to be the stupidest idea I've heard all year.
Yeah, there was, they experimented with some things early in Johnson's tenure that really didn't pan out, and it actually served to fuel the fire a little bit in the hearts and minds of the staff members. Yeah, I would think.
Again, that's just not forward thinking. I mean, you know, when you go into a JCPenney or a Macy's or a Nordstrom's, wherever it is that you're going, most of the people, I think, I'm not a shopper, but I shop online, but I think most of the people in there would be white women, wouldn't they? I mean, as a rule. And women want to touch things. They want to have somebody pull the Coach bag out of the glass case so they can touch it and smell it and open it. And you can't do that with a checkout.
Right. Yeah,
it didn't make sense to me.
Right.
I don't know. And
part of what I tried to do in the book was not just tell of all these great success stories, but to tell the story like of a JCPenney where things didn't pan out quite the way that they should, because there's a lesson in there for my readers. You know, I wrote the executive checklist to really appeal to senior leadership teams and those people in organizations that are aspiring to become senior leaders one day. And I wanted to try to help make their life simpler. So the key concepts that are in the book are, you know, were selected because those are the things that my clients are asking me to help them with. And, you know, we created checklists that basically simplify the execution of those basic strategies. So that's kind of the way the book is set up. And then we sprinkled in 50 or 60 sort of little mini case studies from industry that fortify what we're talking about, you know, in the core of the book. So that's where you get the JCPenney story. It's like how to avoid a communications breakdown that could cost you your business, you know. Had Johnson been more effective in articulating his vision for the stores, if he could have helped personnel see how they would, you know, be part of his vision, you know, they could imagine a better, you know, a better place to work, and that they were going to be part of that transition,
right.
Chances are good they wouldn't have suffered the way that they did.
Well, and again, that seems like it would be a common sense thing. I mean, you want to give people who are the front line, they're the face of the business, you want them to have a bigger picture. You want them to have the story so they're not running around going, oh, geez, oh, geez, oh, geez,
I need to
find another job, or these people don't appreciate me. I mean, we're human.
Yeah.
It seems like they just took the human factor out of it altogether,
which
is a shame. Which leads me to checklist item number 7, and I really wanted to ask you about this. Automate whatever you can. This, I guess, I'm not sure I understand. I mean, automation is important, but what does this do to the employee? What does this do to the number of employees you have? People are already very, very concerned about the lack of jobs and, you know, jobs being taken by, you know, illegal immigrants and all the different things that are going on politically. So automation, to me, although I get it, I'm a techie from, I mean, I'm a techie, trust me, I've got an invisible pocket protector right now, but... automation, I think, scares people because they instantly go, oh. Can you expand on that a bit and tell people what you mean by that?
Sure. That comes out of a chapter that's really focused on business transformation. And what I'm getting at in that chapter is that we need to reimagine the way work is done. So that implies that you need to transform your work environment. And part of the work environment is, you know, how you apply technology to doing the work. So I contend in that chapter that every business is comprised of three things. There's people, they're performing processes, i.e. they're doing work, and they're using tools to do the work. So the tools are the technology. So you've got people, process, and technology that comprise every enterprise. Now, if I'm going to reimagine the enterprise, I have to reimagine how work gets done. I have to reimagine the type of worker I have, the kind of work that they're doing, and the kinds of tools that they're going to use to support that work. And the note about automate whatever you can is really about saying, you know, if you can see that there's an automated solution to do something that is error-prone or is repetitive, that isn't necessarily inspiring your staff, you know, automate it. Because if we can get a computer to do some of this stuff, that's going to free up our personnel to do more interesting things, things that are going to inspire them, things that are going to make them think, and so on. So it's not so much about eliminating people or offshoring, you know, responsibilities or anything. It's really about trying to enable the human factor or the human part of your business to do what it can really do that computers can't, and that's think, you know, and be creative mm-hmm. and be innovative and all of that. And then let's use technology to do the grunt work.
Right, so taking off the busy work or lightening right. the just busy work, you allow the brain to kind of kick in and go, I just had a great right. idea.
Exactly.
Okay. I knew that's what it was, but I wanted to make sure that our audience, because I've read the whole book, it's a great book, by the way, but I wanted to make sure the audience knew that, because we're talking, you know, about different things, which leads me to my next question. When you have a chapter, I mean, it's in that same chapter, I think, but in managementissues.com, you had an interview over there, and you were asked about renovate to differentiate. Mm. What is the thinking behind that philosophy, if you don't mind sharing?
Sure. Yeah, and I do an awful lot of writing there. So, yeah, managementissues.com is a great place. If your followers and your fans aren't aware of it, check it out. It's got some great management leadership articles there. But, yes, renovate to differentiate is really a concept that comes out of, again, business transformation theory, right? How do we transform our businesses? And what we're saying is there's only three ways for a business to really compete. You know, it's around being the provider of choice, the employer of choice, and the investment of choice. And even if you're, you know, a family-owned business, you want to have such a business that the family's willing to invest in it, you know, to keep it going and to help it grow and so on. So you want to really be of choice. And any kind of change or transformation you're going to make inside your business should be about differentiating you so that you can be of choice. And the article in managementissues.com was about that. It was about suggesting that, you know, there's three ways to compete. We all share them. Every business shares that. It's a competition to be of choice in whatever niche you're in. It's a competition for great people to work within your business, and it's a competition for the investment dollar, whether it's yours or the greater investment community, so that you can grow and extend your reach and so on. So in order to do that, you want to renovate, but renovate with an eye towards differentiation in the marketplace, something that's going to make you of choice.
So you want to make sure that you are top of mind when people are going to make a decision, whether it's buying a pair of tennis shoes or
right.
you know, ordering a pizza online. You want to be top of mind all the time.
Right. And to the degree that you can change your business, whether it's the people part of it, the process part of it, or the technology part of it, you want to make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. It's not just, you know, to invest in technology for technology's sake. It's to
right.
differentiate yourself. Yep.
Let's talk about Generation Y. They drive me
okay.
crazy. Is it just,
yeah.
is it just me?
No, it's not just you. And in fact, just today I was with a client. We were talking about some of the strategies to leverage Gen Y better in this business that we were helping. But yeah, the point that kind of brought out through my book, The Executive Checklist, is that you've got a whole new generation of workers entering the workforce, and these folks came up sort of with a computer in their hands, mm-hmm. and they're small computers, right? They're actually telephones and music systems and, you know, cameras and all that kind of stuff. So they're expecting when they enter the workforce that they're going to be able to extend the use of this little handheld device that they've grown up with and do business this way. And consequently, it pushes and pressures businesses today to accommodate this next generation. And along with that, they've got a whole bunch of other attitudes and expectations that I think employers and companies are going to have to react to, respond to, figure out how to accommodate. So these folks are used to, you know, getting pats on the head all the time, right, and told they're great and a trophy for showing up. And, you know, anybody
yep.
that's a little bit older realizes that's not the case, right? When
you're, exactly.
your boss isn't going to tell you how great you are every day, and you're not going to get a reward at the end just because you came to work. You're going to have to do something more outstanding to be recognized. So there's a lot of pressure now on businesses to kind of adjust to this next generation of worker and all of what they're expecting.
I guess my question is, how do you adjust to it? I have to be frank with you. One of the biggest things about this particular generation is their either refusal or inability to write and speak the Queen's English.
Mm.
What the
yes.
heck is that all about? If you send me a resume and I get them, if you send me a resume that is in text chat, text speak,
yeah.
I won't even talk to you. Clearly,
right.
I'm not going to talk with you. And
right.
unfortunately, I'm seeing more and more of that. And I have to tell you, I see that kind of thing, and I just deduct IQ points. It may be unfair. They may be
right.
bright. But I just look at them as like, really, you're too stupid to spell? I'm sorry. Go away.
Right.
Go away.
Right.
So how do
right.
companies deal with that? I mean, what can they possibly do to deal with that?
Well, you kind of touched on a couple of different things that I think make that up, right? So there's this whole ability to really communicate impersonally. And they've learned this, right, by using the phones and the texting capabilities that come in the phones and so on to really communicate. So they've got a whole network of friends that they converse with that way. And it's very matter of fact, that's what they're used to. That's what everybody in their generation who's using these things are expecting, and it's very comfortable to them. Now they come into the workforce, and you've got to pick up the phone and call a client, or you've got to write a formal document, or you've got to, you know, create a memo that's reporting something or asking for additional information or what have you. And they don't have that natural skill set where someone who's older and from sort of, you know, Gen X or the baby boomer generation are kind of sitting there very comfortable doing, because you grew up writing notes and communicating with people on the phone. And, you know, you remember a time when there wasn't cell phones, you know. But this next generation...
I miss those days.
Yeah, right.
I do.
This next generation. Yeah, no, I pine for them as well. But, you know, we're in this new place, and now you get this next generation of worker coming in, and consequently businesses are stressed to deal with it. So some of the things that we're trying to help our clients work through is strategies to integrate this and leverage the good part that comes with this next generation of employee. And that gets into some of the things like, gee, are we using social media as a way to communicate with our next generation of customers? Because while the next generation is the next generation of worker, they're also the next generation for customers. It's the same people. So are we using social media? Are we interacting with them in ways that they're used to? Can they place orders using the phone? Can they ask for service using their you know, messaging system? Is there a network that we could create of like-minded people, you know, sort of a virtual community that we should be trying to integrate with as a business to be able to gain more, you know, acceptance of our product or us as a company. So that's kind of one aspect of what you were pushing on a minute ago, that we're saying, yeah, you know what, let's flip that around and figure out how do we get these people to help us do these things that we don't have already, you know, to enable our business to be more 21st century, if you will. So that's one sort of technique. The other thing is to kind of look at the, and this is kind of implied, I think, with your question, is like, well, what do I do to help these folks develop those other skills they don't have? And one thing is to formalize the training around that and help people with it. You know, you might actually have to teach, you know, assertiveness training, which is more, you know, face-to-face, right? You might have to help them develop writing skills if they don't have them. So there's that kind of, I think, push and pull that's going on in businesses today, and it's part of some of the strategies we're helping our clients work through.
I was having a discussion last week on the radio show with a gentleman who does, he's got a massive company, deals with client appreciation and customer appreciation, and he mm-hmm. was talking about a girl that they had hired. This was before they really started, you know, checking everybody out. He said she was stunning. She was, you know, just this beautiful girl. She was very sweet. And an email crossed his desk, and all he could do was say, "Mother of God, don't let her email anybody else ever again." It was, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was so bad that, and I guess nobody in the organization knew that not only could she not spell, but she couldn't form a cogent sentence or coherent sentence run on. I mean, it was really, really bad. Eventually, they had to let her go. They couldn't retrain her, which, and I find that very sad. Yeah, there are certain skills that you need. So that leads me to my next question. When you're kind of working with this generation, do you have to, and I'm trying to be tactful here, which is not my nature, so bear with me. sorry, I'm trying. But the thing is, I mean, I find, and this is just my observation, that when people are doing this, doesn't matter how old they are or what generation they are, when they're doing this, they're almost asking you to dumb down your brain to play in the sandbox with them. I'm not going to do that. So I guess my question is, do you allow them to kind of continue this tech speak, you know, abbreviated speech and talk to what you think might be their group of people, or do you try to bring the whole group up to a better educational level? Where do you go with that? Was that tactical?
Well, yeah, you know, it's yeah. I mean, I totally hear you. The thing that I think is you got to kind of meet in the middle, because I think you've got really bright, you know, Ivy League educated kids that are texting each other with capital C, capital U, you know, LTR. So
can they spell later? I mean, can they really?
Right. You know. So I think the thing that I'm trying to help clients, you know, look at is, gee, if you've got consumers that are comfortable, you know, in a dialogue that's that way, then maybe it's not that bad, all right? You know, the trick is you got to know your customer. So if they're talking to you in a text, it better be properly, you know, designed sentences and proper spelling and all that stuff.
Right, right.
But if they're
talking to you, so how do you isolate them so they're not, you know, kind of, you know, pouring bleach into the wrong end of the pond there? I mean,
right.
How would you isolate?
That's
because,
the,
look, there are going to be people like me who are terribly offended by it and irritated.
Right.
I mean, you do that to me more than once, I'm gone.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a couple different things that we've got our clients kind of working on. One is customer relationship management. The better you know your customer, the more you know what their preferences are. And you can discern, you know, certain information. The second way that we're doing, this is more in like customer service positions, but if your request for information is coming using that style of communication, the abbreviations, the misspellings, all that kind of stuff, then it's okay to correspond back that way. If the request for information or service is coming with a formal, with more formal language, then you have to use more formal language. So it's, again, a way to give people what they want, the way they want it, and
right.
so on.
Right.
So it's just the beginning of this. I think we're kind of on the cusp of all of this right now, but there are some companies that are really looking at that, and they're trying to figure out what's the best way for me to connect with my consumer. Mm-hmm. And if my consumer's 18-year-old boys and they're going to do, you know, see you later, that kind of thing, then I'm going to talk to them that way because that's what they
right.
what they want. Yeah.
I wonder
so,
what
yeah,
the ripple effect is going to be down the road. I mean, are we raising just generations of illiterates? It worries me. It really does.
Yeah, no, me too.
I don't understand it. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to watch. It really drives me crazy. I get emails and, you know, I have a Facebook group that's very popular, and I've already warned people, don't do that in the group. I will block you. I'll kick you out just as quick as you. You know, we are virtual assistants. We're virtual service providers. If you're going to act like an 18-year-old boy, you're not going to stay in this group. You are a professional.
Right.
Behave as such.
Right.
So I have to police that pretty carefully. And I think, honestly, that some people just think it's cute. It's not cute.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
No, it's annoying is what it is.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
We've
yep.
only got about... Well, I wondered if it was just me because I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm just old-fashioned. Maybe I'm a stick in the mud. I love language. I love to read. I love to spell. What the heck? Stop it.
Yeah.
But
no, I know.
I don't think it's just me. I really don't. Okay.
Well,
so
there's a lot of
this
stuff I'm still learning.
Oh, I bet.
You know, all these acronyms.
I would imagine.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. I can't even look some of them up.
Yeah.
I know. I'll just send back a note and say, can you put that in English, please? I have no idea what
right.
you just said to me. But, okay,
yeah,
we've
somebody
got
sent me something the other day. It was like, I-C-Y-M-I.
Really?
Yeah, and I-C-Y-M-I. I'm like, what does that mean? Oh, in case you
what
missed it.
What does it mean?
Oh, got it.
In oh, that's what that
it.
Is?
Yeah.
Oh.
So anyway.
I'm just going to be old-fashioned.
I'm still learning.
I'm going to stick with with.
Right,
it'll
the spelling.
Be very
right.
interesting. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see where this goes. I mean, I see, you know, no capitalization, run-on sentences, no punctuation. My brain doesn't work like that. My brain, I refuse to play in that particular pond. But I don't think I'm alone, James. I think a lot of people are going to say, oh, no, you don't. You're not going to do that to me. No, no. So I guess that's what businesses have to figure out. You know, how are they they're going to cope with this and who is their audience? Okay, information technology alignment. What is technician? What is that technology alignment? Information technology alignment.
Yeah, and I know we're pressed for time. The easiest way to think
about
2 minutes. Yeah, the easiest way to think about that one is that it's really just making sure that you align your technology strategy with your business strategy. So if you've got certain aspects of your business strategy that's aimed at growth or customer service or product design or what have you, then you want to make sure your technology plan supports the achievement of those business goals. So there's a chapter in the book that's just focused on aligning technology with strategy, and that's really what's talked about in there.
Well, before we run out of time, where can people find you on the web, and where can they find your book?
Well, probably the best place to find me on the web is executive-checklist.com. So that's www.executive-checklist.com. There you'll find a lot of information about the book. You'll find a lot of media. You'll find a lot of articles and so on that complement the material that's brought out in the book. And you can even order the book from there. As far as the book is concerned, it's out in bookstores. You can order it in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, whatever, however you like to consume books, you can get it. There's, you know, e-book versions as well as the hardcover and all of that.
Are you going to do an Audible version at any point?
You know, it's something that I'm playing around with. My publisher is Palgrave Macmillan, you know, major publisher. They're kind of exploring that a bit. I've got some alliances with some other firms that put book to tape and that kind of thing. So we're kind of playing around with the notion. It's so possible. We haven't got a definitive answer yet, but we're looking at that right now.
The reason I ask is, you know, because you use the word consume. It's going to be one of those days. I can tell already. You use the word consume. I consume books different ways. I mean, like your book, the one that you sent me, because you sent it to me, it's going on a shelf where I'm not going to really annotate it. I just don't. A lot of authors will send a book to me and there's a nice note in it or it's autographed and like, okay, that book is not going to get all marked up. So I will go buy the book again. I'll buy it on Amazon, hardback, whatever's available. I also buy it as an e-book, you know, downloadable if the e-book is there or on Kindle. But I also want to listen to it. So I want to consume that book in three ways, one in my hand, one electronically, and I want to hear it as well. So when you get that book up and running on Audible or wherever it goes, let me know.
I sure will, Denise. Thank you.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of people like me can compartmentalize, and we're listening while we work, and it's just, I don't know, it's just something about hearing the author, you know, kind of speak the voice and the passion. There's just something different about reading it. So anyway, well, James, thank you so much. I know your schedule is just incredibly hectic, and I really appreciate you being with me here today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Denise, thank you. It was a great conversation. I'm glad we had a chance to relive a little bit of our past one.
Yeah, we did. We had a lot of fun. I think we did. We covered a lot of what we talked about. I missed the part about Cigna, but we can get that another time. Well, listen, everybody, the show will be available for download in about an hour, and you can find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and James Kerr, and go look at the executive-checklist. By the way, James, I like your website so much, I'm actually building a website that has some similar things as to yours. I'm not copying it. I'm not. But I I like that. So I took away some of the points and went, yeah, it's a very nice website. Being a web developer, I'm always looking at that. Well, listen, everybody, have a great weekend. James, thank you so much. And you have a great weekend as well.
Thanks, Denise.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.